May it please the court. My name is Imani Shafe. I represent Mr. Reginald Geist, the appellate in this matter. Today, Mr. Geist seeks to establish two things, that there was insufficient evidence to convict him for having firearms in the trunk of a car in which he was a passenger, and two, that the district court erred in not giving Mr. Geist's mere presence defense instruction. For today's purposes, however, I'm only going to address issue two, and that's the mere presence issue. In order for a defendant to be entitled to a mere presence or defense instruction, they must establish four things, a four-part test. One, that the proposed instruction is a correct statement of the law. Two, that there is evidence to support the instruction. Three, that the instruction was not covered in some other charge or instruction from the judge. And four, that the district court's failure to not give the instruction denied the defendant a fair trial. Mr. Geist's mere presence instruction that he proffered in the district court satisfies this four-part test. With regards to whether Mr. Geist's instruction was a correct statement of law, the government did not contest that, and does not contest it, and we submit that the instruction proffered by Mr. Geist was a correct statement of the law.
But I guess what I wondered is, if you will, on the third element of this test, one has to look, as you well know, at the instructions as a whole, and even if Mr. Geist was proposing a reasonable instruction, if the ground is basically covered somewhere else, it's not error to refuse to give it. The district court did tell the jury it was supposed to find knowing power and intention to exercise direction and control, and that's really inconsistent with mere presence. So by the time the jury finds what the judge told them to find, haven't we really covered this ground?
I think yes and no, Your Honor. The district court did give the knowing instruction with regards to knowledge.
And control. You know, it's not like I'm just standing here looking at other people doing things. Knowing control.
And did give the constructive possession instruction as well.
Right.
However, Your Honor, we believe in this case that one, after giving, if just putting to the side for a moment, if one believes that the court did give or did cover the mere presence issue in the constructive possession instruction, that the court, by then following that instruction up with the government's joint possession instruction, severely diluted the constructive possession element or the part of that instruction that covered the mere presence.
Well, was it ever ascertained whether Michaels was actually the driver of the car that night, and was he ever charged with anything?
Your Honor, Mr. Michaels was never charged with anything, and there was no conclusive evidence that he was the driver at the time of the incident. But there was evidence that Mr. Michaels had driven the car before, as early as the night before. This happened the early morning, so as early as the evening before, and had been seen driving Mr. Geist around the days and weeks before this incident.
If your real concern is if you're conceding basically that there was enough in the instructions, but there is perhaps not as much emphasis as there might have been had Mr. Geist's instruction been given, I think that's a tough argument to make, because we do presume that juries follow the instructions that they're given. If the jury's told, you know, the knowing control part, if the jury's told that the theory of the defense is that it's somebody else who possessed those firearms, again, implicitly, Mr. Geist just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Why isn't it our obligation to assume that the jury paid attention to what it was being told?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we're not conceding that the instructions covered the mere presence part of the instruction.
Okay.
I think the main reason we're not conceding that is One, I guess to say it differently, is it's one thing for an attorney or someone with legal knowledge to parse the instructions and look in the meaning or look behind the meaning of the constructive possession instruction to determine whether or not that covers the defense theory of the case or the mere presence portion. But we think it's something entirely different to ask laypeople to try to ascertain whether the defendant's theory of the case, the mere presence instruction, is covered by that or not. And then I think that's further compounded by then reading the next paragraph, which then talks about, has three or four sentences that talks about, well, you don't, even if you don't find Mr. Geis possess these weapons, you still can convict them. Mm-hmm. And so we don't think it was covered, and we don't think it was covered.
Okay.
You know, once you went to trial, did Mr. Geis continue to press his claim that he slept through the car chase?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Was there any other evidence surrounding the arrest that could support his claims?
Which the claims made at the time of his arrest?
Yes.
No, Your Honor, our theory...
It changed.
It changed. Our theory at trial was that based on our witnesses and evidence proffered from the government's evidence technicians, is that all the firearms were in the trunk of the vehicle, that there was no firearm under Mr. Geis's thigh. And therefore, our theory of defense was that Mr. Geis was a passenger and was just merely present.
Okay.
I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Your Honors, the mere presence issue was indeed covered by the instructions provided to the court, and it was covered quite well. With respect to the definition of knowing, the jury was instructed that the defendant, in order to be convicted, the defendant had to have realized what he was doing, and that he had to be aware of the nature of his conduct, and he had to have not acted through ignorance, mistake, or accident. I mean, that, as a factual matter, that plainly covers the defense theory, which was that the driver of the car was the owner and possessor of the guns, and that the defendant had no knowledge of their existence.
Did the government ever present any evidence that the firearms he possessed were either used in separate courses of conduct or were acquired at different times or different places?
No, Your Honor. The government did present evidence with respect to the interstate commerce aspect of the guns, but there was no evidence that the guns had been used in other crimes.
Which two did the jury convict him of possessing? In other words, there were three guns in the trunk.
Correct.
Were the three guns in the trunk
Same
three with the serial numbers obliterated?
No. The jury convicted the defendant of the one gun that the officers found concealed beneath his thigh inside the passenger compartment of the car. And then in count three, the jury convicted the defendant with respect to the three guns that were found in the trunk. The obliterated serial number, if I recall correctly, there was the one that was found beneath the defendant's thigh had an obliterated serial number, and two of the three guns that were located in the trunk had obliterated serial numbers. The jury did not convict on either count with respect to the obliterated serial numbers. Count two had charged knowing possession of a gun with an obliterated serial number, and the gun that was subject of count two was the one found under the defendant's thigh. Count four charged that the defendant knowingly possessed the two guns with obliterated serial numbers in the trunk of the car. The jury acquitted on both of the counts related to obliterated serial numbers.
So four guns?
There are four guns total, Your Honor.
Two convictions. Okay.
Now, with respect to the mere presence instruction, the defendant has stated that the government conceded that the instruction that was proffered was a correct statement of the law, and I do want to make clear that the government conceded that it was in the correct context. The government argued that the context with respect, context of this case made the giving of that instruction not only unnecessary, but improper in that it had the potential of confusing and misleading the jury in that it suggested, particularly when it was opposed to the instruction defining knowingly that I just read to Your Honor, it suggested to the jury potentially that evidence of the defendant's presence and proximity to the guns was irrelevant to their inquiry. And that, of course, would have been an improper and incorrect statement of the law if the jury were to have understood the instruction in that manner.
Do we have a double jeopardy problem here because of the entering of two judgments of conviction on the handgun possession counts?
Do you mean with respect to the count one and count three? Is that what you're asking? No, we don't. The law suggests that possession at any particular time, that a single possession of multiple guns at a particular time and place should be charged in a single count. In this case, because the defendant possessed one gun under his thigh and separately constructively possessed the three guns in the trunk, then it's the government's view that the charges were properly brought in that way. And
well, did you allege that he acquired the handguns that were found in the trunk separately from the gun concealed under his thigh?
No, Your Honor. The defendant was not charged specifically with acquiring the guns at all. We did charge that he possessed them separately in that he actually possessed the one gun underneath his thigh and he constructively possessed the others in the trunk of the car.
But to be sentenced on multiple counts of 922 G1, doesn't the government have to prove that the firearms were acquired separately and at different times or places?
I should note that this issue was not raised below, and so it was not
fully
addressed.
I'm aware of that.
But in the case of the sentencing with respect to Mr. Geis, the sentence was based on the totality, under the guidelines, the totality of the guns. You're asking whether separate judgments should have been entered, and it's the government's view that it was appropriate to enter separate judgments given the nature of the conduct for which the defendant was convicted.
Even though the government never proved that the firearms were acquired separately or at different times and places, Connolly?
Your Honor, it's the government's view that in that case the issue was acquisition. I think that it would be better, since this was not raised below and not addressed, for me to respond by letter if you'd like a full discussion about this, because I have to say I'm a little uncomfortable just up here talking without having even recently read that case. So
hey, why don't we give you 10 days?
That would be fine, Your Honor. It'd be
14?
Either way, Your Honor, I think I can do it.
Give you an opportunity to respond 14 days thereafter.
Judge Rogner,
let's make it 10 and 10.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll take care of that.
I haven't been doing that for a long time.
Pardon me?
I haven't been setting, schedules for a long time.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I appreciate the time. I do want to answer your factual questions, though, before I part today. And you asked, for one question that you asked was whether it was ever ascertained that Mr. Michaels was the driver. And I do want to let you know that it was not only never ascertained that he was a driver, but in the government's view, there was substantial evidence indicating that he probably was not the driver. That evidence is discussed in the brief. In addition, the only evidence that Mr. Michaels even existed was the testimony of Ms. Williams. So, in fact, it was not even ascertained by the government that
you mean existed globally or existed at the time?
Existed in, we never were able to, he was never identified by anyone except by Ms. Williams at the trial. The jury had no occasion then to...
Is there such a human being? Is that what you're trying to get across?
That's not in the record, and we don't know.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So, in answer to your question, don't know that at all. So it's the government's position in sum that the jury instructions fairly and adequately presented the issues to the jury, and the jury accurately followed those instructions as best we can tell, and certainly the evidence was ample to support the defendant's convictions on both counts. We would ask that Your Honors affirm.
Thank you.
Your Honors, with regards to whether the mere presence instruction is covered in the instructions given by the district court, what we believe happened in this case is that the district court gave the constructive possession instruction and then followed that up with a joint possession instruction, and essentially buttressing the government's theory of the case with regards to the firearms in count three. It's the government's theory of the case that Mr. Geis constructively possessed them, and if you don't believe that, he then could have still jointly possessed them with the driver of the automobile. And there is no dispute it was someone else driving the automobile. The government's not contesting or not stating that Mr. Geis was the driver of the automobile. It was someone else. And there was testimony and evidence that Mr. Michaels had driven the automobile very soon before the arrest in this case. And so what the instructions did in this matter was to buttress the government's argument and essentially give prejudice Mr. Geis by not essentially allowing him to point out his theory of the defense instruction or his theory of the case instruction in the instructions, as the government was allowed to do from both the constructive possession instruction given by the court and the joint and sole possession instructions given by the court.
And you're certain that Mr. Michaels exists?
There was testimony to that effect, Your Honor, from Ms. Williams. The government cross-examined Ms. Williams. Ms. Williams stood by her testimony that a person named Keith Michaels did exist. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you.